Oh, they're endless. They're endless, aren't they? The opportunities. Well, they are, because people love plants. And when you look at where do you buy plants from, there have been so many other people come and go into our industry that think they can do it. And yet garden centres are supreme at it.
Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Phil.
And this is The Underground, the podcast for garden sector professionals. Each week, we discover the trailblazers and innovators who are shaping the future of garden care in the UK. So, without further ado, let's get down and dirty.
So, we're delighted to welcome Boyd Douglas Davis onto The Underground today.
Good morning.
Welcome, Boyd.
Lovely to be here.
We're going to just crack straight on. So, Boyd, you've been involved in horticulture for most of your life. Can you tell us a little bit about this and what it is about horticulture that keeps you in this industry?
Yeah, well, I have been, you're right, all my life, really, because I was born into it, is the truth. So if I go back to my grandfather was a seed merchant up in Preston and that part of the world. Then my father worked for a seed merchant, moved down to Oxfordshire, and he had a series of garden shops when I was a wee nipper. And then by the time I was seven, he'd got a garden centre in Stratford-on-Avon, and that's my starting, was working on a Saturday morning, weighing up bags of potatoes and loose dog food and all that sort of thing. So literally, I've spent all my life in it. I've only ever worked in the industry.
Right.
And it's an easy one. Why, really? Because it's just fantastic. I just love the variety, the fact that I've done 40 years and I can't ever think that there's been a press repeat moment, because no 2 years are the same and the industry's moved on so much across that time that I've never found myself getting bored. And I suppose that's why I'm still here, still doing what I'm doing.
You mentioned one of the things that you like about the industry is the fact that it's constantly evolving. What are some of the biggest changes that you've seen in the garden centre business over the years?
I think technology has arrived,
right,
which makes some things so much easier, doesn't it? In that you can now place orders with your suppliers so quickly. You can see their availability of actually what they've got, real stock. So there's a lot of great stuff. I think also technology, though, has played a big part in marketing in terms of people becoming much more aware of gardening, solutions to gardening. Years ago, you used to put on talks. Bless him, good, great Peter Seabrook would go out and come to our garden center, and he'd do a talk, and you'd have 300 people, 400 people sit and listen to him, because how else did they learn about gardening?
Yep.
Nowadays, thousands of people can watch a podcast, a reel, an Instagram piece, can't they? And technology allows them to learn when they want and actually learn where they want to learn. So if they want to learn how to prune a clematis, they can be in the garden looking at the video and doing it real time, can't they? So technology is a massive change. That, where was that? You know, when I was at Pershore College, it wasn't a thing we discussed.
No.
Technology. I think we were just starting to talk about different coloured welly boots back in those days. So that's a big thing. I think the appetite for gardening has changed over time in a way, I think. And I think particularly the COVID piece, that particularly the first and first two lockdowns, really changed how people valued the ability to go outdoors. It was one of those classic situations where you take for granted what you don't think about, and as soon as you lose it, you suddenly value it, don't you?
Absolutely.
And I think people were suddenly realizing that the freedom to step out the door and go where they want, when they want, was a huge thing that they had not really appreciated. So I think that has brought in a different generation as well. That's brought people in much younger. So when I was in my early days, we talked about, oh, you're not old enough to garden yet because your life hasn't evolved. You haven't gone through the nightclubbing age of the 20s, the young family age of the 30s. So when you get to your 40s, you'll discover gardening and then you'll start to listen to your dad or your granddad or your mother about gardening. So different now. And I think that's a change. You see so many, which is wonderful, young people, couples in garden centres now, who are buying houseplants, they're buying food crops, So you see them in the seed aisle, you see them in the vegetable plant section, buying plants that is probably 20 years ahead of when their probably the parents or grandparents were buying plants. So that's a big change. And of course, then the big change of all, I suppose, is the way garden centres have really embraced the complete year-round business model.
Right.
Instead of being something which was super busy in the spring, and the amount of seasonal staff that we used to have to let go then after the spring, maybe keep one or two on through the summer because we got a Christmas season coming and a bit of an autumn gardening, but that whole middle gap was too big a space. But garden living, garden lifestyle, garden leisure has filled that in. Then Christmas is superb, isn't it? Instead of being something that was quite good, it's unbelievable in garden centres. And then the January, February trade with the restaurants has meant the garden centres are really an all-year-round business. Mm-hmm. And years ago, I would have said we were much more seasonal.
Yeah.
I mean, you've touched on it a little bit there, Boyd, but I was just wondering whether you saw much of a difference between garden centre retail and high street retail, you know, what the differences are there?
Well, I suppose the massive difference, when I think about, well, my dad, if I think about that shop back in Stratford-on-Avon, it was an in-town urban garden centre. So that was in the mid-70s. Proper plants, you know, plant department, outdoor plant yard, little fencing and garden structures department, shop selling all the usual things. And then those completely disappeared, didn't they? Every garden outlet moved onto a out-of-town site and became garden centres. But interestingly now, there are sort of re-emergence of particularly houseplant shops, aren't they? But this urban plant shop focusing on houseplants and I think touching on a bit of alpine and a small bit of seasonal bedding and things, but predominantly houseplants are back in town, aren't they? So there is that going on as well, which is a bit of a complete circle back round. But that's then servicing, I'm sure, the urban gardener that's got a balcony or a courtyard, a small outdoor space. And nowadays I know a lot of younger people who don't bother having a car. So getting access to plants at a local within walking distance is really important for them, isn't it? So I guess they will succeed. Where they do the job really well, they'll succeed. I saw one which was a cafe. It was pots of tea and pots of plants. I thought that was a lovely little combo. So it was a cafe, so you could sit in there and it was doing something which was just nice, simple menu, nice and easy, but almost a pop in for a cup of tea and a small cake or a sandwich or a jacket potato. It wasn't trying to be anything extensive on its menu, but really simple, really well done. And you sat in amongst all the plants and every plant was labelled, was in top condition and was for sale, and clearly for sale. It wasn't... They were there for the decoration. You were sat in the middle of the shop. And I thought, well, that was a lovely combination to bring people back on a really regular basis for the catering and inspire them to buy. So I think there's changes like that, but in effect, they're taking us back to where we were 45 years ago, aren't they, with high street shops.
Tucking that away for later.
Yeah.
New business opportunity.
I think we all know that garden centres are facing a number of challenges at the minute. What do you see are some of the biggest challenges that they're up against?
The constant challenge, which is the easy one, and we probably just tick that one off, is of course the weather is every year is a challenge for a garden centre, almost every year. Occasionally it's not a challenge, but it's very rare. So that in itself makes garden centres have to think about how to deal with the weather, because it isn't something which is ever going to suddenly fit into our industry's patterns, is it? We're always going to have problems. The amount of water we've had this last year, thinking about actually how to encourage gardening in a way that will cope with all that extra water, getting people to think about trees actually are quite achievable in pretty much any size garden, because you just got to prune them hard if you want to keep them to size. Yet probably for years people have said, oh no, I can't fit a tree in my garden. Well, a tree is a fantastic way of actually soaking up a huge amount of water, isn't it? And that type of gardening technique, which will support the challenges that weather brings. But beyond the weather, the more recent ones, undoubtedly getting plants from Europe has been a challenge. And as much as I'm sure all the British growers and retailers really want to source plants in the UK, that is then tempered by you can't get enough plants in the UK. And I know many garden centres would love to buy everything they actually need from a UK nursery, but that just can't happen at the moment. And that's a challenge for growers, because there are some really strong growers out there who I know want to expand on their production, but they are constantly having to go through huge loops with planning applications and local authority who have all that control over planning. As much as at the highest level, governments say they want to invest in environmental horticulture and support the industry, when it comes to actually planning permission, it drops right back down to the local authority and often to mm-hmm. an individual in the planning department. So growers who want to expand are struggling or finding it quite long, hard projects to get themselves into building new glass or tunnels, or even just getting beds put down on ground and putting down the roadways that they need to service the beds, because they can put the plants down, but without planning, they can't put the roads down. So that's okay. a problem. I think we're seeing the next phase of the import regime, aren't we, with border control points moving in structure and system. And, well, we need to watch this space on how that goes. But Absolutely. The problems that growers abroad are having in getting plants to the UK is a concern. And then the other one is, which all these things are all linked back into, is financial. It's, you know, the numbers, the pressure on business nowadays, the labour costs to actually staff your garden centre or your business or your lorries to put them on the road, the fuel costs, all those things are piling up. And I think if you look back over the last 10 and 20 years, there has been little, if any, price increases in plants really to accommodate any of those cost increases. So it's getting harder and harder from a garden centre operator to actually make a sustainable business where they can actually keep reinvesting. And that's the challenge, isn't it? That a garden centre is, it's a well-worn building. When you've got a busy garden centre, you've got a busy car park, you've got busy catering, a lot of people on site using your toilet facilities, all of those things cost a huge amount of money. And garden centres are getting worn out. And I think we saw that when the Wyvale centres were sold, that they were all very worn out, and that had been years and years of footfall and little refurbishment cost. And that's the big problem. So if the weather's not great, the turnover doesn't happen, if the costs keep on rising and we can't get price increases on plants to match that. And that's where we need to be working with growers, and we need to be working with the public, because the public, I think we all get worried about you can't charge that much for a plant. But actually, when you've got so many new customers, when your 3 million new people came gardening in the lockdown period, what would they know about price of plants? They would know nothing, because they were brand new to gardening. So 10% of the customer base was absolutely brand new. And I've always thought there's a constant churn. Sadly, our customers reach an age where they don't still come in gardening anymore. So you lose customers at one end, you gain at the other end. Yeah. So you've got that constant shift. But we've got to be confident in what the value of a plant is, and not just in terms of, yes, that's worth £10, but blimey, aren't those plants fantastic in what they do for me, what they do for my environment, what they do for the people around me. And I think the particularly younger people do really value plants and appreciate them now. And I'm not saying we should charge too much, but we've just got to charge what they're worth. And I feel at the moment we're below that in terms of where we should be. It is, I think that's the big challenge, isn't it? Is getting the value of what we do actually to find its way to the till point and actually be paid for. Yeah,
in so many ways. So we've talked a little bit about the challenges facing garden centres, but what do you see are the positives and the opportunities that are out there now for garden centres?
Oh, they're endless. They're endless, aren't they? The opportunities. Well, they are, because people love plants. And when you look at where do you buy plants from, there have been so many other people come and go into our industry that think they can do it. And yet garden centres are supreme at it every single time, aren't they? So actually to have a situation where we're brilliant as an industry at what we do is is a great starting point. And then, you know, we touched on COVID, but the additional interest in plants, gardening, the environment, the space we all live in, And I think the biggest change from when we were all enthusiastic about organic gardening 10 or so years ago, or maybe 15 years ago now, organic was this big new thing. And then credit crunch arrived and everybody went, I'm just going to buy the cheapest carrots I can find. I'm just going to buy normal cucumbers. And organic went straight back out the window for the majority because people were strapped for cash.
Yeah.
I think it's a different world now in terms of, yes, life is tough at the moment, bills are high, but the value of looking after our environment, people are so much more concerned about it, and they understand the part of tree will play, or a house plant will play, or a basket hanging outside their front door will play. So I think the demand for plants and all that goes with plants is huge. The opportunity, I think, for the most savvy garden centre operators is actually about creating a real sense of community within their garden centre, so that they really become the place to go. Because technology, as great as it is, does allow people that opportunity to access data when they want it, where they want it. But actually, there's nothing better than learning from real people face-to-face, sitting down with a mug of tea in the potting shed. It's why allotments work so well, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, is it for the allotment you go, or is it for the social and the interaction and the learning? So garden centres need to, I think, embrace that. That's a big opportunity. Because if you go to a garden centre on a Saturday morning and you meet 10 other like-minded gardeners and you walk around with them in a plant area and they're telling you what to buy, I reckon you'll fill your trolley twice. Whereas best one in the world, no garden centre in the country has enough staff to look after 10, 15, 20 people all at the same time on a Saturday morning. You just don't have the resources anymore. So I do see it as a real win for the garden centre in that it will become busy. And also that volunteer army of garden enthusiasts, if you embrace them and let them into your garden centre, then they're going to be really, really good at advocating for your products and helping you sell more. So I think that's a big opportunity. Without doubt, food in every sense is an opportunity for a garden centre. I think there are still garden centres out there, retail nurseries, who haven't tackled food as a service item. So they might have a few biscuits and an ice cream freezer and a bottle of pop freezer, but they haven't ever gone down the road of catering. And I talk to people and they say, oh, it's quite tricky catering and it's going to cost a lot of money. I don't agree with either of those things in that you don't have to spend a fortune. You can, you know, can have a really effective catering offer by getting a bacon butty van and 10 tables and sets of chairs and putting it in your plant area canopy. Yeah, it's a self-contained catering unit where you've got a limited menu, but actually you can do some really great. And it's not about the range in your menu. It's about the quality of your menu. Yeah. So if you put on the best bacon and egg sandwich on a Saturday morning with a lovely flat white, it doesn't matter it's coming out of a caravan.
No.
It's the environment and the quality. So I think catering's still a big thing, and it's what's driving people to garden centres, particularly in those quieter times. So I think opportunity there. And also that pop-up catering for established garden centres where they've got a restaurant and they say, oh, our restaurant's not big enough anymore, but we can't expand it, we can't put any more orders through our kitchen, our wash-up won't cope. Well, add additional catering in a different part of the garden centre. Think differently, go lateral and think about food for a different market. So I think catering's a big opportunity. And I think the other space, of course, is houseplants. In terms of plant categories, houseplants, I don't think we've seen the end of that growth yet by any means, which is wonderful because everybody has got, if they have no garden space, you've at least got a studio flat. You know, the extreme, isn't it? And you've still got a window and you can put a, I saw on Pinterest loads of wonderful indoor, traditionally you say it was a manger to go outside your window to put your summer bedding plants in or your window. And I've seen people putting those on the inside of the windows now. So they've got a houseplant trough on the inside.
So an inside window box.
An indoor window box, exactly. You think, wow, isn't that a great thing? And that's young people thinking about space much more than we ever do, because we've probably got that bit more space and wouldn't need to think about it. But they're thinking, how can I do this? How can I get more into my space? hanging yeah. macrame and putting hooks up on the walls to drop things down and have hanging plants. I think there's a big opportunity in all those areas. And I think just being great at customer service, because I think that if anything, people have become more demanding as consumers post, again, the COVID, make people think, hold on a minute, I don't want to spend my money on something which is inadequate or inferior or poor service. I want great service. And garden centres are full of really enthusiastic people who love talking about the product they've got so they can deliver great service. So that's another opportunity we've got over places where you go, and maybe some of the staff sometimes are just there because it's a job and everybody needs a job and they turn up and they do the job. But how enthusiastic can you get in shops on the high street if it's not actually something you really enjoy yourself?
It's passionate about, yeah.
Something which we've got.
I love that. So many opportunities and reasons for garden centres to be positive. That's brilliant. We're going to take a short break, but in the meantime, it's time for Kate's Corner, where we discover the musings and sage advice from the gardener guru. So, Kate, what are we going to be talking about this week?
Well, Phil, we're going to be talking about the importance of feeding. So what a lot of people forget is that, yes, plants need water, and you've got plants in compost, which often contain some feed, but pretty soon that plant is going to run out of all that nourishment. So you do need to do supplementary feeding. Not so important in beds and borders if you're constantly mulching and looking after that soil. But plants in containers, ones that are growing really well. And now with the sun coming out, now's the time when you want to think about some supplementary feeding. Can be liquid feed, granular, whatever floats your boat. But if your plants are starting to look a little bit yellowy, then now is the time to start feeding.
So look out for the yellowing of the leaves.
Yeah, and there is an issue, some people are saying, with peat-free compost, that you might need to start supplementary feeding a little bit earlier. So I would just say, really look at your plants, see what they need. Don't go overboard. Always, always read the instructions. Don't add a little bit more for good luck. You really, really need to be controlled when you come to feeding.
So, you know me too well.
I do indeed. So yeah, don't just splash it on. You will really notice the difference.
Perfect. Top tip, Kate. And back to the show. Now, I know that you've been involved and are still involved in a number of different organisations, Boyd. And I was thinking about the House of Lords special inquiry into horticulture last year, which you spoke at. And I was wondering if there was some sort of coordination between the organisations about what you were going to say to deliver a unified message.
Yes, the lovely thing we've got now, which has been going for a long time, but I think has gained more value, is the Environmental Horticulture Group, which sits across all aspects of the industry. So it represents everything from the Arboriculture Association, who are often unseen because they get lost, and people think of trees as forestry, but yet the trees we look at outside our windows, the trees in the street, the trees in public and urban space are so valuable. So you've got arboriculture, you've got barley, the Landscape Institute representing all the landscape industries. You've got the RHS, the HTA, NFU, GCA, YPHA, Chartered Institute of Horticulture, all members, everybody that has a trade organisation, or in the case of the RHS, of course, a consumer organisation, we all belong to EHG, and I have the privilege, and it's fun and privilege, and it's an entertaining and challenging space to chair that at the moment. But our single function is to ensure that the value of horticulture is understood by those in government, both appointed to government and employed within offices in government, and anybody in the opposition. Really important as well to talk to them at the moment. So we do work hard, and we have a secretariat in London who do an awful lot of work in ensuring that messaging is shared, so that things like that special inquiry, we were able to provide briefing to many of the people who spoke there, just to ensure that the facts which have been gathered up over the years by HTA and RHS and so on, those facts were shared, because it makes so much easier to make an argument or a case when you're armed with that set of data, when you know the impact on our industry mm-hmm. by investing in it, and how many more staff will be employed. And that's a projection done by the Oxford Economics Group, where they projected through and said, well, given the scale of industry at the moment and given some investment in it and where the world is going, that will bring up the number of people employed to maybe nearly 700,000, so an extra 200,000 to 300,000 people. So when you're talking about 750,000 people employed in our industry, it's important to get that information across. When you look at some of the things that UK horticulture is doing, you know, the way that UK horticulture is leading on peat-free production across the world, you know, we are ahead of everybody else.
Yeah.
So when we say, you know, world leading, it is absolutely true.
Yeah. No, that's brilliant. We mentioned there about the HTA and now the EHG and a whole raft of other acronyms that you mentioned, but you're also involved in the YPHA, the Young People in Horticulture Association, and Green Fingers as well. What is it that keeps you involved and motivated to be part of these organisations?
Well, two separate things, really. The YPHA and Young People in Horticulture, it's unbelievable. It's honestly unbelievable to see what they're doing. And I went to Pershore College in the mid-80s and studied garden centre management course. I think within 2 years of me leaving, the course had failed due to a lack of enthusiasm or lack of attendees. Right. And you can't believe that. And you think the industry's grown beyond belief since then, mm-hmm. and yet the ability for people to learn and be encouraged into the industry as young people is really lacking in so many ways. Mm-hmm. So the YPHA was a group of young people who are in the industry who felt that they needed to create something for themselves. So they started it, which is incredibly fortunate, as it turned out. They started it at the beginning of 2020. So they created this group. They started networking on social media. They started chatting to each other. Then, of course, they had the 2 months later, the horrors of shutdown. But why I'm supporting them is because I just saw those youngsters. And the youngsters make them sound like the teenagers. They're everything from any age to 35.
Yeah.
And they really, really came together in that lockdown period because they were sat. So you've got growers, young people working on their parents' nurseries where the nursery was also their home. The house was literally in the middle of the nursery. And they'd seen 20 years of mum and dad hand building tunnels and creating that business. And then overnight, potentially losing the whole thing. The young people talked to each other and shared their experiences, and they actually started coming up with solutions and ideas, and they really motivated each other. So that was phenomenal. They'd done that, and thank goodness that they had put that together. Because if they hadn't have got that off the ground in the January, it certainly wouldn't have come together in March or April, would it, when everything else was going on? Nice. And since then, they've evolved. And there are 850 members now. So it's as a membership organisation, it must be the fastest growing industry organisation that's ever been in horticulture. Brilliant. They now meet a couple of times a year for meetings. So I went down to the Eden Project recently, and there was about 60 of them managed to get all the way down to – that's a fair old hall, isn't it, right down to St Austell. But it was a brilliant day.
Yeah.
Oh. And the team at Eden were incredible. They were so hospitable. They took us all behind the scenes. They gave us great guided tours. And the level of chat before, during and after between these people who went and those that couldn't go were so enthusiastic to learn about it. So the sharing of photographs and social posts and things. So this group is just working so hard to make great careers for themselves. And they're creating friendships as well, of course, that are going to last forever, aren't they? They're going to be friends for life, which is going to be a great source of knowledge and inspiration. So I love what they're doing. So that's why when they asked me to become an ambassador for them, they realized I was a little bit outside of the under 35 bracket. So they were like, politely said, you can't join you, but you can be an ambassador. And so I just love spending time with them. And I'm going to be a mentor on their, they've got this new learning program, the Launch Success program, which is for 10 people. And that starts in July, and we're off to Holland to see the new plant. We're off to Floramedia to see the label factory.
Wonderful.
And the 10 candidates who are being chosen right now. I had a lot of applications for it, which again, that's wonderful.
That's great. Really? That's brilliant.
Huge amount of applications. So there's a big interview process going on through technology online in the evenings. Mm-hmm. So it's great. So they're wonderfully, brilliantly exciting, and their enthusiasm for what they're doing and for our industry just makes you think, brilliant. You know, these 800 odd people are going to make such a difference to horticulture over the next 20, 30 years. And it's all sorts of horticulture. You don't have to be plant enthusiast. You can be a compost scientist. You can be a landscaper. You can be an accountant or a marketeer working in a horticultural business. You've just got to work in horticulture. So it's wonderful. And then Green Fingers, I've been involved with them since Richard Jackson created it, really, which goes back 25 years now. So he, 25 years this summer, he was at Gardeners World Live, and he was conscious that there was a lot of plants going to be spare, show garden plants, that what really and materials and landscaping materials that had been used for the show. And he gathered up quite a lot of the exhibitors and said, why don't we do something more lasting with this? And he took all those bits and bobs and created a fantastic garden. And that was the first garden. And at the time, his intention was just to create a garden from that show. But of course, when you look at what the gardens do, and they're all in children's hospice gardens, so they're always providing facility at children's hospice, he realized that actually there was a lot of children's hospices in the UK, and almost none of them had a garden. So hence Green Fingers was created. And now there's over 25 years, they're just shy of 70 gardens have been created, which is incredible. And I mean, I got very involved with them, particularly there was a turning point for me, which was I met a young boy called Billy at an event in London, where it was a fundraising event for Green Fingers, and his mum was the speaker, and she'd been invited to talk about how their family had been impacted by a garden because, sadly, her daughter had been in the hospice on end-of-life care, and they'd used the hospice garden in their last few days. So she spoke very eloquently about the value of the garden and the difference it made. And she brought Billy along, who was 8 years old at the time. And Billy is absolutely a classic East End lad, real little strutty little lad who was there with his mum, and he was itching to talk. And after she'd done her speech, we were then stood around talking, and excuse the awful East End accent that's about to hit your earphones, but he said, "Hello, mister, did you build a garden my sister died in?"
Oh.
And I didn't know what to say to him, because he was like this smiley little face who just said the most horrific thing about his sister had died in this garden. And I said, well, I didn't, Billy, actually build the garden, but I was a bit involved with it. I know about the garden. Why? And I was speechless, which is rare for me. And Billy just went, because it was terrific. We had so much fun. And I suddenly realized that actually, whereas up till then, I'd always thought of gardens as being there for the patient, and they were for the child that was in the hospice. And it suddenly dawned on me that actually it was about the memory of the child in many ways. Yes, it's for the child, the days they spend there. But there was Billy, who was an eight-year-old boy, talking about his sister with a big smile on his face and remembering how terrific it was. And I thought, what is the alternative to that memory? That could have been, were you the man that painted the walls in the room that my sister died in? Were you the man that plumbed in the equipment? You know, absolutely all really critical, vital bits, but not what you want him to remember. And I'm sure now, 15 years on, that Billy's memory of his sister is still exactly the same, that she died in a terrific garden. And that's, to me, why the Green Fingers gardens are so incredible. And there's no end to the need. I mean, there was only 50, just over 50 hospices in the UK. So you'd think, well, you've built nearly 70 gardens, it must be done. But it's not the case, because hospices have developments and they expand, they have new buildings, yeah. that impacts on the outdoor space. It creates either new space, it removes yeah. the old space. 25-year-old gardens are in need of refurbishment.
Yeah.
So those are being refurbished. Gardens are still being created. There probably won't be many more hospices built in the UK over the next 25 years, but the demand for the gardens and improving them will continue to be there. And the difference is, well, from a garden of 15 or 20 years ago, it was a pretty garden with some nice plants, mm. something pretty to look at. Now they're therapy space. Yeah. They actually have covered outdoor seating, yeah. covered space where the staff can actually go and have a break, because you forget that the staff yeah. and the families and the carers need sometimes to take a moment, don't they?
Yeah.
So that garden provides space for them to do all that. So it's a far more complex thing now, yeah. and it costs a lot more money. But when you see the impact it has on somebody, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. And the team at Green Fingers, yeah, they just keep on going, building Amazing. These gardens.
Yeah.
Wonderful garden designers and landscapers and so on they use. But, mm-hmm. yeah, it does some great stuff. And I'm so happy that the industry really seems to love Green Fingers and yes. really supports it really
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
what an inspirational story that is. It's really good and really encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to change the subject for a moment. I noticed recently, Boyd, you posted on LinkedIn about petitioning any canvassing MPs to get horticulture onto the curriculum by getting children to grow one edible and one flowering plant. Why is it, do you think, that gardening and horticulture are not seen as important, especially within the government's view of education? And what value do you think it brings?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've always, every election up till now, I've dreaded that somebody knocking on my door saying, can you give us your vote when it comes to the election in 10 days' time? You think, oh, yeah. goodness me. You know, I've literally ducked behind the sofa thinking, no, pretend you're not in and ignore them. And now I thought, well, actually, there is a real message, and that is make sure that every child grows a plant and, even better, grows two. Mm-hmm. And this has come about, the conversations we've had with government, I've come to realise that to get education to accept horticulture as a curriculum subject, so to put it alongside the French and the Latin and the Spanish and all those other great subjects that we get given at school and we have to do whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
For the horticulture to land in that space, it's at least a 10-year timeline from government saying yes to it actually getting there because of developing the curriculum.
Yeah.
So it's yes, ultimately that's the big ask for the curriculum to include horticulture. But that's a long time before, A, it's going to get agreed to, and, B, it's actually ever going to get delivered. So this easier ask, it comes from a colleague on EHG, Martin Emmett, who's a director at the Fire Plants Group down at Tristan. He came up with this idea because he chairs the Education and Employment Committee within EHG. And he said to me recently, if we could just get one plant grown, the value to school children to understand how a seed germinates, how it takes time, how maybe that plant then needs different types of care from the windowsill in the classroom through to the space it might end up in. And if you imagine that if kids were all growing sunflowers, they would understand then that it can look pretty, but it also can be a food source, and they start to understand the pollinating aspects. And there's so many loops back round. And then you take that sunflower and start measuring growth and using it in maths. Mm-hmm. So actually that one plant can play its part across so many lessons in the school day that suddenly plants are at the heart of everything they're doing. Mm-hmm. And rather than trying to make plants an hour-long session once a week, why don't we make plants part of as many subjects as possible? And then you start talking about the names and the common names and the Latin names of plants, and that brings in languages and history, and they can talk about geography and where the plants come from and how did those plants get to here. So they start talking about great plant explorers and about opening up of the new world many years ago. And you can get into all these different aspects, all from that one seed,
yeah.
literally going through to a plant. Yeah. And that's why when Martin sat and sort of explained this idea, and I thought, absolutely brilliant. And I think I nicked his idea and said, let's actually grow two plants, one to eat and one to look at. And I think that brings different aspects again. And then if people start appreciating how it is quite tricky to grow food sometimes, mm-hmm. and the variances to crop outputs and things, they might start to then value food, which will be a really important thing to value food. Yeah. But more importantly for me, and we're only a week away from my favorite time of the year, which is asparagus season, living where I do, right in the heart of asparagus country. Seasonality. Wonderful. If children then start to understand seasonal produce and not expect Brussels sprouts in June, as much as I love them, they're not good, are they? They are never good. So seasonal, British grown, you don't need to see food from all around the world on the shelves in the supermarkets all the time, mm-hmm. when you can grow a perfectly healthy menu out of a British garden space. So I think that would be great to see about edibles and about flowering, because I do think flowering is really important, isn't it? Be an annual bedding plant. The difference it makes when you walk outside and you see a hanging basket with some pansies in on a cold, dreary winter's day, it just makes you smile, doesn't it? So yeah. I think actually flowers and food, so growing two plants would be brilliant. And if we got that to happen, I think it'd be so much easier to then get plants and horticulture as part of the curriculum and take it through from that early stages right through to secondary education, which it really is lacking again at the moment, gosh, yeah. in secondary and yeah. further education.
Yeah.
We've just really got a massive gap, haven't we?
We really have. And children want to learn as well. We saw that with Tim Peake, didn't we, when schools were growing rocket that was taken up into space, and kids absolutely just jumped onto that. And I used to teach horticulture in schools, and the kids really just want to learn.
Yeah, yeah.
As you said, as soon as they hit secondary school, it's all just left. So, yeah, I love that idea, though, of growing two plants. I love it. So, Boyd, your passion is coming through about the horticultural industry. But do you actually enjoy gardening yourself?
I do when it's not raining. So that's I don't have a greenhouse or anything to scurry right. away to in the bad weather. So I'm not a wet weather gardener. My enthusiasm for gardening is creating gardens. So the actual building of the garden, creating the borders right. and the yeah. the design. So lovely. We're very lucky. We actually moved house just over a year ago. So we have a whole new set of gardens to create, which is the bit I love. And I'm quite keen on cutting things back, whether it's grass or shrubs, that side of things. So, yes, I do enjoy gardening. And I love, particularly, one of my passions is actually about planting something every month so that
okay.
you get a full 12-month garden. And you know, you go to a garden centre in January and you see something that's wonderful, buy it and plant it. So I'd like to create a garden. So I
that's lovely. I like that.
I'd like to think that the last house, that the garden was, there was always flowers in the garden. You know, it was a year-round garden. And yeah. I used to go out in the winter and do a photograph and then post out on the Facebook or whatever, you know. Yeah. Whatever was in flower in the garden. I could have 10, 12, 15 things in flower in January, February. And wow. it is, I do like that. So I like the design and creation. That's my side of it. I'm not a big fan of weeding. I do think that's a bit of a time waster, really. So again, right. planting that actually really fills the space and covers the ground. I don't think soil should be seen, really. Soils for growing in, not for looking at.
Is there a garden tool or a gadget that you couldn't do without?
Well, I couldn't have done without my strimmer over the last few weeks, because the lawn got right away from me in the winter. So the strimmer is a pretty essential piece. I found that trying to get on the lawn with a lawnmower when we've had the awful wet weather we've had for so long since last summer, that it just doesn't happen, and then the grass is too big, so I'm going to have to go and strim the lawn to get half a chance of then getting the mower on it. So the strimmer is probably the most essential, and I actually ran out of strimmer line yesterday, so I'm waiting for to go and get some more this afternoon, because the job was not completed, so that was a bit of a shame. So my strimmer is probably the most essential. If you took my strimmer away today, Phil, I would be very upset. On that, and then a good pair of sharp secateurs, of course, for cutting things back. I don't think people cut plants back hard enough generally, do they? The public, they're a bit scared of pruning. And I think actually so many plants flourish when you actually push them back a bit. They come back harder at you and they flower even more determinedly. So I think that's a message we somehow need to get through to. And then they put a shrub in a garden and it fills up a whole lot of space, and that stops them buying two or three more shrubs. So I think the industry themselves needs to work harder on the merits of pruning.
It's a good one. There's a partnership coming up, I can see with Felco. So, boy, that's the tools. Do you have a plant or a flower that will always put a smile on your face no matter what kind of mood you're in?
Well, I've got an evergreen favourite. So Choicia Sundance is
unusual.
Absolutely, well, it just seems to me that it's one of those plants that it only needs the tiniest bit of sunlight on it and it absolutely glows back at you. Yeah. So all year round, it just looks brilliant, doesn't it? And I think that, it throws sunshine back in your face, doesn't it? So I'd say as an evergreen, that is a must in any garden. I'm tempted to actually, I've been dallying with planting a hedge of it, actually, all the way down the side, out the front, which I've seen done once before, and it looks stunning. And it is probably a good anti-foil to the Fittinia invasion that we've got of Fittinia hedges all over the UK, which is a fantastic plant. I love it. But Choicia Sundance for sure. And then if I'm allowed a second, I do love Nemesia Confetti, the flowering plant, again, because it just does such a good job so long. Yeah. And again, you can cut it back in the summer, during the summer, you can cut it back two or three times and it'll just keep on flowering at you. So again, that just feels like hugely great value, and it feels like a plant that just loves doing it. And it was when I was on the Webb's Nursery, we launched Nemesia Confetti there as one of our exclusive introductions all those years ago. And it was, I also like it because it was our best selling ever plant. So it was a great seller, but it's a great doer. No, those are my two.
No, I love Lamisha. I really do.
Thank you so much, Boyd. Really do appreciate your time chatting with us. It's been really insightful. It's been fantastic.
Pleasure.
Really interesting. Yeah, and I love your passion, even after all these years.
All these years. You're making me sound old now. No, it's a great industry, isn't it? It's a great industry full of great people. That's a lovely thing, isn't it? Everybody's so friendly. Yeah. You just have great conversations with people.
Yeah, definitely.
It's wonderful. So thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, could I ask a small favour? Please take the time to review the show and share us with your colleagues. It really does make a difference and will help others to find us too. To keep up to date with the latest happening from the Underground, sign up to our email newsletter at theunderground.fm. I'm Kate Turner, the Gardener Guru. I'm a horticulturist, garden consultant, and presenter. To find out more, check out my website at gardenerguru.co.uk.
And I'm Phil Wright, the founding partner of Wright O'Barra, a creative marketing agency specialising in the home and garden sectors. And for anyone bringing a new product to market, we've created a handy 7-step guide to help take your product marketing from zero to hero. Find out more at writeobara.com. Thanks for listening.